I stood with my lamp held out over the stair rail, and he came slowly within the circle of its light, looking up with an incomprehensible air of being touched and pleased by the sight of me. I made out that he was substantially dressed, but roughly, like a voyager by sea, that he had long, iron-grey hair, that he was about 60, muscular, browned, and hardened by exposure to weather. As the light of the lamp included us both, I saw, with a stupid kind of amazement, that he was holding out both his hands to me.
Pray, what is your business?
Our business? Ah, yes. I'll explain my business. By your leave.
You wish to come in?
Yes. I wish to come in, Master. Yes.
He pulled off his rough outer coat and hat, and I saw that his head was furrowed and bald. Once more, he was holding out his hands.
What do you mean?
It's disappointing to a man, after having looked for us so distant, and come so far. But you're not to blame for that. Neither on us is to blame for that. I'll speak in half a minute. Yeah. There's no one now, is there?
Why do you, a stranger coming into my rooms at this time of night, ask that question?
You're a game one. I'm glad you've grown up. A game one.
I knew him. If the wind and the rain had driven away the intervening years, had scattered all the intervening objects, had swept us to the churchyard where we first stood face to face on such different levels, I could not have known my convict more distinctly than I knew him now, as he sat in the chair before the fire. Reluctantly, I gave him my hands. He grasped them heartily, raised them to his lips, kissed them, and still held them.
You acted noble, my boy. Noble, Pip. And I have never forgotten it.
Stay. Keep off. Surely you must understand that I...
You were just saying that surely I must... Understand? What surely must I understand?
That I cannot wish to renew that chance intercourse with you of long ago under these different circumstances. I am glad to believe you have repented and recovered yourself. I am glad to tell you, sir. I am glad that thinking I deserved to be thanked, you have come to thank me. But our ways are different ways, nonetheless. You are wet and tired. Will you drink something before you go?
I think that I will drink before I go.
I made him some hot rum and water, but when at last I put the glass to him, I found his eyes were full of tears.
I hope that you will not think that I spoke harshly just now. I had no intention of doing it. I'm sorry if I did. I wish you well and happy.
As I put my glass to my lips, he stretched out his hand. I gave him mine, and then he drank.
How are you living?
I've been a sheep farmer, stock breeder, other trades besides, away in the new world. Many a thousand miles of stormy water off from this.
I hope you have done well.
I've done wonderful well. There's others went out along with me, as has done well too. But no man has done nigh as well as me. I'm famous for it.
I'm glad to hear it.
I hope to hear you say so, my dear boy. May I make so bold as to ask how you have done well since you and me was out on them lone shivering marshes?
How?
Oh. Forgive me, walking.
I have been chosen to succeed to some property.
Might a mere warrant ask what property?
I don't know.
Might a mere warrant ask whose property?
I don't know.
Could I make a guess, I wonder? Has your income since you come of age? As to the first figure now. 5. Concerning a guardian, there ought to have been some guardian or such like whilst he was a minor. Some lawyer, maybe. As to the first letter of that lawyer's name now, would it be J?
All the truth of my position came flashing on me, and its disappointments, dangers, disgraces, consequences of all kinds rushed in such a multitude that I was borne down by them and had to struggle for every breath I drew.
Put it as the employer of that lawyer, whose name began with a J and might be Jaggers. Put it as he had come overseas to Portsmouth and had landed there and had wanted to come on to you. However did I find you out?
No.
Why? I wrote from Portsmouth to a person in London for particulars of your address. That person's name, why? Wimmy. Yes, Pip, dear boy. I've made a gentleman on you. It's me who would have done it. I swore that time, sure as ever I earned a guinea, that guinea should go to you. I lived rough, that you should live smooth. I worked hard, that you should be above work. What odds, dear boy? Do I tell it for you to feel an obligation? Not a bit. I tell it for you to know, is that there hunted dunghill dog what you kept life in got his head so high that he could make a gentleman. And Pip, you're him.
The man appalled me. The dread I had of him, the repugnance with which I shrank from him, could not have been exceeded if he had been some terrible beast.
I'm your second father, Pip. You're my son. More to me nor any son. When I was a hard-out shepherd in a solitary hut, not seeing no faces but faces of sheep, till I half forgot what men's and women's faces was like, I seen yours. I dropped my knife many a time in that hut when I was eating my dinner or my supper, and I says, here's the boy again, a-looking at me while I eats and drinks. I see you there many a time, as plain as ever I see you on them misty marshes. Lord, strike me dead, I says each time, and I goes out in the air to see it under the open skies. But what if I get liberty and money? I'll make the boy a gentleman. And I've done it. Why, look at you, dear boy. Look at these here lodgings of yours, fit for a lord. A lord, aye, he shall show money with lords for wages, and beat them. Look at your linen, fine, beautiful. Look at your clothes, better ain't to be got. And your books, too, mounting up on their shelves by hundreds. And you read them, don't you? You shall read them to me, dear boy. You ain't looked slowly forward to this like I have. But didn't you never think it might be me?
Oh, no, no, no. Never, never.
Well, you see, it was me, a single-handed, never a soul in it but my own self and Mr. Jaggers.
Was there no one else?
No. No. Who else should there be? Oh, dear boy, how good-looking you have grown. As bright eyes somewheres, what you love the thoughts on?
Maybe.
They shall be yourn, dear boy, if money can buy them. Not that a gentleman like you, so well set up as you, can't win them off of his own game. Let me finish my telling. From that there hut and hiring out, I got money left me by my master and got my liberty and went for myself. In every single thing I went for you. And it all prospered wonderful. I'm famous for it. It was the money left me, and the gains of the first few year what I sent home to Mr. Jaggers. All for you. But was a recompense to me, looking here, to know in secret that I was making a gentleman. The blood horses of them colonists might fling up the dust over me as I was walking. What did I say to myself? If I ain't a gentleman, nor yet ain't got no learning, I'm the owner of such. All you own stock and land. Which on you owns a brought-up London gentleman? In this way I held steady afore my mind that I would for certain come one day and see my boy and make myself known to him on his own ground. It warn't easy, Pip, for me to leave them parts. Nor yet it warn't safe. But I held to it, and the harder it was, the stronger I held, for I was determined, and my mind firm made up. At last, I done it. Dear boy, I done it. Where will it put me? I must be put somewheres, dear boy.
To sleep?
Yes, and to sleep long, sound, for I've been sea-tossed and sea-washed months and months.
My friend and companion is away. You must have his room.
He won't come back tomorrow, will he?
No. Why?
Because, look here, dear boy, caution is necessary.
How do you mean?
By God, it's death. I was sent for life. It's death to come back. There's been overmuch coming back of late years. And I should of a certainty be hanged, if took.
Nothing was needed but this. The wretched man, after loading wretched me with his gold and silver chains for years, had risked his life to come to me, and now I held it in my keeping.
Can I have some of my gentleman's linen to put on in the morning?
Yes. I'll lay it ready.
For an hour or more, I remained too stunned to move. Then, gradually, I began to know how wrecked I was and how the ship in which I had sailed was gone to pieces. Miss Havisham's intentions towards me, all a mere dream. Estella not designed for me. And where Joe and Biddy were concerned, I could never, never, never undo what I had done. Twice I could have sworn there was a knocking and whispering at the outer door. I entered his room. He had rolled a handkerchief round his head, and his face was set and lowering in his sleep. But he was asleep, and quietly too, though he had a pistol lying on his pillow. Assured of this, I softly removed the key to the outside of his door and turned it on him. Not to get up a mystery with people, I resolved to announce that my uncle had unexpectedly come from the country. Soon after early dawn, I notified the lodgekeeper.
A stranger asked for you, sir, just before 11.
I've said, my uncle. He'll be staying a short while.
Likewise, the person with him?
A person was with him?
Well, I judged him to be, sir. The person stopped when your uncle stopped to make inquiry of me. And the person took the way when your uncle did.
What sort of person?
Well, a working man, sort of dust-coloured clothes and a dark coat.
Anything else?
Oh, well, I didn't rightly look hard.
My mind was much troubled by these two circumstances taken together, the arrival of my convict and a stranger lurking. I lit the fire, prepared breakfast, and waited.
My dear boy!
I don't even know what name to call you. I've given out that you are my uncle.
That's it, dear boy. Call me uncle.
You assume some name, I suppose, on board ship.
Provis.
What's your real name?
Magwitch. Christened Abel. Provis, sir, huh?
When you called in at the gate and asked the watchman the way here last night, had you anyone with you?
No, dear boy.
Are you known in London?
Not over and above, dear boy. I was in the provinces, mostly.
Were you tried in London?
Which time?
The last.
First knowed Mr. Jaggers that way. Jaggers was for me. And what I done is worked out and paid for. This is good. I'm a heavy grubber, dear boy, but I always was. If it had been in my constitution to be a lighter grubber, I might have got into lighter trouble. Likewise, I must have my smoke. And this is the gentleman what I made. A real genuine one. Because it'd be good for to look at you, Pip. All I stipulate is to stand by and look at you, dear boy. There's something worth spending in that there book. It's yourn. All I've got ain't mine. It's yourn. I've come to the old country for to see my gentleman spend his money like a gentleman. And blast you all, blast you everyone, from the judge in his wig to the colonist to stirring up the dust on me. I'll show you a better gentleman than a whole kit on your put together.
Stop! I want to speak to you. I want to know what is to be done. I want to know how you are to be kept out of danger. How long you are going to stay. What projects you have.
Look here, Pip. I forgot myself. What I said was low. That's what it was. Low, Pip. Look over it. I ain't going to be low. Now, go on, dear boy. You was a-saying?
First, how are you to be guarded from the danger you have incurred?
The lights are great. Who knows? There's Jaggers, and there's Wemmick, and there's you. Who else is there to inform?
Second, is there any chance person who might identify you in the street?
I don't intend to advertise myself in the papers by the name of Abel Magwitch, come back from Botany Bay. Pip, if the danger had been 50 times as great, I should have come to see you just the same.
Third, how long do you remain?
I'm not going back. I've come for good.
Fourth, where are you to live? Where will you be safe?
Dear boy, there's disguising wigs, and spectacles and black clothes can be bought for money. As to the how and where of living, dear boy, give me your own opinions on it.
You take it smoothly now, but you were very serious last night when you swore it was death.
And death by the rope, in the open street, not far from this. But to go back now would be as bad as to stand ground. Worse. I'm here, Pip, because I've meant it by you. Years and years. So, let me have a look at my gentleman again.
I'll find somewhere nearby when Herbert comes back in 2 or 3 days.
Who?
My friend. You're using his room.
If he's to know, even then, dear boy, we'll have him on his oath. On this.
And he pulled out a greasy little black testament I'd last seen when he'd made me swear on it in the churchyard oh so long ago. Finally, he agreed to remain shut up in the chambers until I had been to Little Britain.
I merely want, Mr. Jaggers, to assure myself that what I have been told is true.
Told or informed? Told would seem to imply verbal communication, and that's impossible with a man in New South Wales.
I will say informed.
Good.
I have been informed by a person named Abel Magwitch that he is the benefactor so long unknown to me.
This is the man in New South Wales.
And only he?
He alone.
I am not so unreasonable, sir, as to think you at all responsible for my mistakes and wrong conclusions, but I always supposed it was Miss Havisham.
As you say, Pip, I am not at all responsible for that. In communication, Magwitch appeared to me to have obscurely hinted at some distant idea he had of seeing you here in England. I cautioned him that I must hear no more of that. That he was expatriated for the term of his natural life, and that his presenting himself in this country would be an act of felony, rendering him liable to the extreme penalty of the law. He guided himself by it, no doubt.
No doubt.
I have been informed by Wemmick that he has received a letter under date Portsmouth from a colonist named Purvis.
Or Provis.
Thank you, Pip. Perhaps you know it is Provis.
Yes.
The letter asked for the particulars of your address on behalf of Magwitch. Wemmick sent them, I understand, by return of post. Probably it is through Provis that you've received the explanation of Magwitch in New South Wales.
It came through Provis.
In writing to Magwitch, or in communicating with him through Provis, have the goodness to mention that the particulars and vouchers of our long account shall be sent to you, together with the balance, for there is still a balance remaining. Good day, Pip.
I went straight back to the temple, where I found the terrible Provis drinking rum and water and smoking negro head in safety. The influences of his solitary hut life were upon him always, and gave him a savage air no dress could tame. In 1,000 small, nameless instances, arising every minute in the day, there he was, prisoner, felon, bondsman, plain as plain could be. Every hour increased my disgust and hatred. Then, thankfully, after 5 days, Herbert's footstep on the staircase. Provis, who had been asleep, staggered to his feet, his jackknife shining in his hand.
Quiet, it's Herbert.
Handel, my dear fellow! How are you? How are you? How are you? You're thin and pale. I beg your pardon.
Herbert, this is a visitor of mine.
It's all right. Dear boy, take this book in your right hand, Pip's comrade. Lord, strike it dead on the spot. If ever you split in any way, some ever. Kiss it.
Do as he wishes.
Shake. Now you're on your oath, you know. And never believe me on mine. If Pip shan't make a gentleman on you.
In vain should I attempt to describe the astonishment and disquiet of Herbert when he and I and Provis sat down before the fire and I recounted the whole of the secret. Enough that I saw my own feelings reflected in Herbert's face, and not least among them, my repugnance towards the man who had done so much for me. It was midnight before I could leave him in the room we had found for him in Essex Street and return with relief to my own.
What is to be done?
My poor dear Handel, I'm too stunned to think.
The dreadful truth is, Herbert, he's attached. Strongly attached to me. Was there ever such a fate? What can I do? Cut him off? Never take another penny off him? I'm heavily in debt, bred for no calling and fit only to go for a soldier. How can I repay him?
You can't repay him by soldiering. You'd be infinitely better in Clarica's house, small as it is. But there's another question. This is an ignorant, determined man who has long had one fixed idea. More than that, I may misjudge him. He seems to me to be a man of desperate and fierce character.
I know he is. I've seen him almost murder a man.
See, then, think of this. He comes here at the peril of his life for the realization of his fixed idea. In the moment of realization, after all his toil and waiting, you cut the ground from under his feet, destroy his idea, and make his gains worthless. It is unimaginable what he might do under the disappointment. That is his real power over you as long as he remains in England. And that would be his reckless course if you forsook him.
Then what is to be done?
The first and main thing is to get him out of England. You will have to go with him. And then he may be induced to go.
But wherever I get him, how can I prevent him coming back?
Newgate. And if a pretext could be made out of that other convict, or out of anything else in his life...
I know nothing of him, except as the miserable wretch who terrified me for 2 days in my childhood.
Handel, you feel convinced you can take no further benefits from him?
Fully.
And you feel convinced you must break with him?
Yes.
And you have, and are bound to have, that tenderness for the life he has risked on your account, that you must save him, if possible, from throwing it away?
Yes.
Then you must get him out of England before you stir a finger to extricate yourself. In heaven's name. And we'll see it out together, dear old boy.
Herbert, of his life, I must ask him point blank.
When we sit at breakfast in the morning.
I'd like to know more about that man and you. It's strange not to know about you.
Will, you're on oath. Both on you.
Assuredly.
Yes.
My life, short and handy. In jail, out of jail. In, out. That's it, pretty much. Down to such times as I got shipped. After Pip here stood my friend. I've been locked up more than a silver tea kettle. I've been done everything to pretty well, except get hanged. Started off thieving turnips. Then I was left to myself. I got the name of being hardened. Ask yourselves whether you would have been over ready to give me work, being a bit of a poacher, a bit of a labourer, a bit of a wagoner, haymaker, hawker, a bit of most things that don't pay and lead to trouble. That's how I got to be a man. And then, 20 years ago, at Epsom Races, I got in with a man whose skull I'd crack with a poker. His right name was Compeyson. That's the man you see me pounding in that deep pit, my dear boy. He set up for a gentleman. He'd been to a public boarding school and had learning. For a smooth talking and a dab at the ways of gentlefolk. Good looking, too. Very noticing look.
I think this is a man might suit.
To judge from appearances, you're out of luck.
Yes, master. And I've never been in it much.
Luck changes.
There's room.
What can you do?
Eat and drink, if you'll find the materials. Laugh them here. Give me 5 shillings. His business was the swindling, handwriting, forging, stolen banknote passing and such like. He'd no more heart than an iron file. He was as cold as death. There was another in with him, by surname Arthur. He was in a decline. There was a shadow to look at. Him and Compeyson had been in a bad thing with a rich lady some years afore, and had made a pot of money by it. But Compeyson betted and gamed. He'd have run through the king's taxes. Arthur was dying, and had the horrors. Well, the second or third time I ever seen him, he comes tearing downstairs for Compeyson's wife in only a flannel gown and his hair all in a sweat.
Sally, she really is upstairs along of me now, and I can't get rid of her. She's all in white, with white flowers, and she's awful mad. She's got a shroud hanging over her arm, and she says she'll put it on me at 5 in the morning.
Fool. You know she's got a living body. How could she be up there without coming through the door here?
She's standing at the foot of the bed, awful mad. And over where her heart broke, you broke it. It's blood.
Get this drivelling, sick madman back up. And Magwitch, give her a hand, will you? And give him his liquor.
Come on,
he'll quieten.
There she is again. She's lifting me up. Keep me down. Keep me down.
And he lifted himself up hard and was dead. Pip's comrade?
Yes.
To Compeyson, it was good riddance. He made me swear on this book like you have. And he cut me into such nets as made me his black slave for 4 or 5 years. And no mercy. My missus. There ain't no need to go into her. And last, me and Compeyson was committed on a charge of putting stolen notes in circulation. He's his. Separate defences. No communication. I sold all the clothes I had except what hung on my back afore I could get Jaggers. In a box, despite his eyes ever moving, he looked young, innocent. Me, Five means have been tried afore. I've been knowed up hill and down dale in bridal wells and lock-ups. And when the verdict came, wanted Compeyson as was recommended to mercy on account of good character and bad company. He gets 7. Me, 14. I told him, out of this court, I'll smash that face of yours. And he was protected. I'd have gone to below, dear boy. When I got out of that prison ship on them marshes, I was given to understand by my boy here, Compeyson was escaped as well as me. I hunted him down. I smashed his face. Then the soldiers come. Of course, he gets the best on it. His character was so good. I was put back in irons, brought to trial again, and sent for life. But I didn't stop for life, dear boy. And Pip's comrade, being here.
Is he dead, Compeyson?
He hopes I am. If he's alive, that's sure. I'll never know no more of him.
Pip, Miss Havisham's half-brother was called Arthur. Compeyson is the man who professed to be Miss Havisham's lover.
If Compeyson was still alive and discovered Provis, he would inform on him to rid himself of the threat. But before I could consider leaving the country with my patron, I had to see Estella. I discovered that she was at Satis House. The next day, I had the meanness to feign that I was under a binding promise to go down to Joe. Herbert would take care of Provis. After a drizzly ride, the early day came up halting, whimpering and shivering like a beggar. I breakfasted at the Blue Boar when in slouched Bentley Drummle.
You just come down?
Yes.
Beastly place. Your part of the country, I think.
Very like your Shropshire, I'm told.
Not a bit. You stay long?
Can't say, do you?
Can't say. Large tract of marshes about here, I believe.
What of that? Are you amused, Mr. Drummle?
Not particularly. Waiter.
Yes, sir?
That horse of mine ready?
Brought round to the door, sir.
Look here, you. The lady won't ride today. Weather won't do.
Very good, sir.
And I'm dining at the ladies.
Very good, sir.
You still lose your temper.
Mr. Drummle, you are not competent to talk on that subject. I did not seek this conversation, and I don't think it an agreeable one.
I'm sure it's not. I don't think anything about it.
With your leave, therefore, I suggest we hold no communication in future.
Don't lose your temper. Haven't you lost enough without that?
What do you mean, sir?
Waiter.
You quite understand. I dine at the young ladies.
Quite so, sir.
Choking and boiling, I watched him through the window seize the horse's mane, mount in his blundering, brutal manner, then sidle and back away into the rain. A man in dust-coloured dress had held the horse, and from his slouching shoulders and ragged hair, he reminded me of Orlick.
And what wind blows you here, Pip?
She was seated on a settee near the fire. Estella, on a cushion at her feet, knitted.
What I have to say to Estella, Miss Havisham, I will say before you in a few moments. It will not surprise you. It will not displease you. I am as unhappy as you can ever have meant me to be. I have found out who my patron is. It is a discovery unlikely ever to enrich me in reputation, station, fortune, anything. There are reasons why I must say no more of that. It is not my secret, but another's. But when I fell into the mistake I have so long remained in, namely that you were my patron, you led me on.
Yes.
Was that kind?
Who am I, for God's sake, that I should be kind? You made your own snares. I never made them. What else?
I should be false and base if I did not tell you that you deeply wrong both Mr. Matthew Pocket and his son Herbert, if you suppose them, unlike the rest of your relations, to be other than generous, upright, open, and incapable of anything designing or mean. Miss Havisham, if you would spare the money to do my friend Herbert a lasting service in life, but which, from the nature of the case, must be done without his knowledge, I could show you how.
Why without his knowledge?
Because I began the service myself more than 2 years ago without his knowledge, and I don't want to be betrayed. Why I fail in my ability to finish it, I cannot explain. It is part of that secret which is another's, not mine.
What else?
Estella, you know I love you. You know that I have loved you long and dearly. I should have said this sooner, but for my long mistake. It induced me to hope Miss Havisham meant us for one another. While I thought you could not help yourself, as it were, I refrained from saying it, but I must say it now. I know I have no hope that I shall ever call you mine, Estella. I'm ignorant what may become of me very soon, how poor I may be, or where I may go. Still, I love you. I have loved you ever since I first saw you in this house. It would have been horribly cruel in Miss Havisham to practice on the susceptibility of a poor boy through all those years as an idle pursuit, but I think she did not. I do think that in the endurance of her own trial, she forgot mine, Estella.
When you say you love me, I know what you mean as a form of words, but nothing more. You address nothing in my breast, you touch nothing there. I don't care for what you say at all. I have tried to warn you of this, now have I not?
Yes. I thought and hoped you could not mean it. You, so young, untried and beautiful, Estella. Surely it is not in nature.
It is in my nature. It is in the nature formed within me. I make a great difference between you and all other people when I say so much. I can do no more.
Is it not true that Bentley Drummel is in town here and pursuing you?
Quite true.
That you encourage him and ride out with him. And that he dines with you this very day.
True.
You cannot love him, Estella.
What have I told you? Do you still think, in spite of it, that I do not mean what I say?
You would never marry him, Estella.
Why not tell you the truth? I am going to be married to him.
Estella, dearest, dearest Estella, do not let Miss Havisham lead you into this fatal step.
I am going to be married to him. The preparations for my marriage are making, and I shall be married soon. Why do you introduce the name of my mother by adoption? It is my own act.
To fling yourself away on such a brute.
Should I fling myself away upon the man who would soonest feel, if people do feel such things, that I took nothing to him? It is done. I shall do well enough, and so will my husband.
But...
Say no more. We shall never understand each other.
He's such a mean, stupid, brute!
Don't be afraid of my being a blessing to him. I shall not be that. Come. Here is my hand. Do we part on this? You will get me out of your thoughts in a week.
Never. You are part of my existence. Part of myself. You have been in every line I have ever read. Since I first came here, the rough, common boy whose poor heart you wounded even then. You have been in every prospect I have ever seen since. On the river, on the sails of ships, on the marshes, in the clouds, in the sea, in the streets. Estella, to the last hour of my life, you cannot choose but remain part of my character, part of the little good in me, part of the evil. But in this separation, I associate you only with the good, and I will faithfully hold you to that always. For you must have done me far more good than harm. Let me now feel what sharp distress I may. Oh, God bless you. God forgive you. Afterwards, I remembered that while Estella looked at me merely with incredulous wonder, the spectral figure of Miss Havisham, her hand still covering her heart, seemed all resolved into a ghastly stare of pity and remorse. All done. All gone. To avoid Drummel, everything, I struck off immediately to walk all the way to London. It was past midnight when I crossed London Bridge. My readiest access to the temple was close by the riverside through Whitefriars. As it seldom happened that I came in at that gate, and as I was muddy and weary, I did not take it ill that the porter should ask my name.
Ah, I was not quite sure, but I thought so. There's a note here, sir. The messenger what brought it said, would you be so good as to read it by my lantern? There.
Thank you.
It was in Wemmick's handwriting, and it said, simply, don't go home.